My brother Jack, thank you again for those words of welcome, for God's wonderful people in the sanctuary. I'm so happy to identify with you. I was listening to that beautiful song. I call it a song because it's the song that God has burnt into our hearts in all its simplicity and yet so tremendously sublime. Jesus loves me, this I know. And you know, we sing that song back in South Africa because your Jesus is our Jesus too. And your God is our God too. And we just rejoice in this, the wonder of his love for us. I think that both Phil and I have had one of the happiest days, the Lord's Day, for many a year. We've got to know so many of you. You've accepted us and you've made us feel so much at home. My only regret is that tomorrow we're going to be leaving. We're going back to campus, Southwest Seminary, where our son, his wife and three children, our three grandchildren, are studying and preparing for full-time service for God. And we're going to go back to South Africa with happy hearts. Because I know that if ever they have a need at any time, they can just be referred here to Brother Jack and to folk who know their parents. And it'll give to us this wonderful thought that God's people in the United States will be caring for God's people from Southern Africa. Thank you so much for listening to me this morning. And I know that this evening may be just a little longer than usual. You'll appreciate that it's a life story, really. I'm trying to confine it in just about 1 hour at a time. And if any of you get up and walk out because you're feeling tired and weary, don't be embarrassed. I have so many, many of my own people back home who have the problem of walking in their sleep. I won't hold it against you. And I'm sure that you've heard a definition of what a preacher is. A preacher is someone who speaks in other people's sleep. So we're going to trust God tonight. What I have to share with you, I believe, must center all around Jesus. It was he and he only who did it all. But I do want to honor and pay tribute to those men of God whose souls were touched by his nail-pierced hand, who had a part in bringing me into the kingdom of God. Though a long process, they are not alive to tell the story of their personal testimony, but their lives live on, and I praise and thank God for that. One of my favorite verses in the scriptures is found in 2 Corinthians chapter 1 verse 10. And I've inscribed it in the Old King James Version in Dr. Moffat's translation, which is a beautiful up-to-date translation of what the gospel of Jesus is all about. Listen to what that verse says. He rescued me from so terrible a death. He rescues still, and I rely upon him for the hope that he will continue to rescue me. Can you say amen to that? He rescued me, he rescues still, and will continue to rescue until that glorious day when he comes again. It was September 1939 that planet Earth was plunged into the Second World War. I was in my late teens at the time, and I enlisted in the South African Army. And after 12 months of intense combat training, we were prepared and ready and drafted for Egypt in North Africa, where the great battle was raging. I shall never forget the time of departure from home. It was a traumatic experience. And I often see again in my mind the scene of my godly mother, who was so much shorter than I am, standing with her hands on my shoulder, looking into my eyes, and then in her words, first of all, gave me a reminder, and then secondly, a request. The reminder she gave me was this: son, your mama will be praying for you that God will keep you brave. And the request was this: my son, never forget the God of your parents. Well, I was glad about the reminder of her praying for me, because I knew I would need that very much, and only God knew how much I needed her prayers. But as for remembering the God of my parents, war was not for Sunday school boys. War was for men, and God was as far from my mind as he could ever be in that short time of having left home. After about 18 months of desert warfare, there came the tragic day in the history of the Second World War, when the German forces surrounded Tobruk in North Africa, and Rommel with his panzer troops took into the bag, as they called it, 17,000 South African prisoners of war. I had been captured several weeks previously west of Tobruk at a place called Akroma. It was a beautiful Sunday morning, the bluest of blue skies, the brightest of sunshine, when we, a small contingent of men, found ourselves surrounded by these massive German tanks. And then one of them came right into the center of the circle, as it were, and a man stood up through the turret, and with a loud megaphone voice he cried out to us, "For you, the war is over." What a traumatic experience for a young man to realize for the first time that he would be a prisoner, no freedom, to be confined behind barbed wire like an animal. But the words that he uttered, "For you, the war is over," they still echo in my mind as they mock, because that was not the end of the war for me. That was the beginning of the greatest conflict that any individual can be involved in, when there is a conflict for the soul of a man. We were drafted over to Italy as prisoners, and after spending about 8 months in Italy, not behind barbed wire, I don't like to be confined, and so we planned and plotted an escape, and we succeeded, and for many months we moved to the northern part of Italy where we lived and fought with the partisans. But there came a day when I was recaptured again with a group of men, and because we were dressed in civilian clothes, we were suspect spies. They took us into Nazi Germany, and after intense interrogation, the Red Cross intervened. And instead of being shot as spies, we were sentenced to spend whatever years there were of our lives in German labor camps. In all that time, I had not heard once the voice of the God of my parents. And now he was going to begin to speak, and to speak in answer to the prayers of my little mama way back home. We were traveling in a huge army vehicle late one afternoon. A group of about 60 men confined to the one vehicle in transport to a German labor camp. When I, who sat at the rear end of the vehicle, hoping I might have opportunity to escape, looked toward the cab side, and there I saw another prisoner sitting with his back to the cab, looking in my direction. But his eyes were focused on me. And I don't know if you've had the experience of knowing that someone is staring at you, and you look and you can feel the eyes burn through you. It was that kind of a feeling. I looked aside and I peeped again through my fingers, and there he sat. He had a beard that came down to his chest, and he had a smile from ear to ear, and his eyes were just focused on me. And I resented that. I thought in my mind, it's all right for you. You look healthy. And you have a beard that must have made you the champion beard grower in any war prison camp that existed. You see, as prisoners of war, you didn't have opportunity to shave. And to pass time, we had various competitions when men would be sitting in rows and they would be exhibiting the beards that they had grown. They would test the texture and the color, and you'd get points for the length of the hairs and what have you. And then the winner would get a prize of 3 cigarettes. And I thought in my heart, you know, you must have won every beard growing competition. But it doesn't give you license to sit there and grin with amusement at my poor effort. You see, mine was like a football game. I don't know how many men you have on each side. Way back in South Africa, we have 11 on the one side and 11 on the other side. And that was my best effort. I had about 11 on each side of my chin. And I resented this man who sat there with the champion beard. So as the vehicle was moving, I rose up and I wobbled my way over to where he was. And I looked right down and I can see those bluest of blue eyes as he looked up into my face. With that smile that could never be erased. And I hit him right across the cheek. And he just sat and gazed up. What do you do in a situation like that? You men, tell me. It took the wind right out of my sails. So I just stood and I said to him, "You're a coward. Get up on your feet and fight." And from where he sat, he looked up and he said to me, "I don't know you, but I know you need a friend." And I said, "Chum, maybe I need a friend, but I don't need a coward for a friend. Stand up and fight like a man." And this fella stood up. And he stood up. And he stood up and I said, "Hello." But he put his hand behind his back and he looked down at me. And he was a giant of a man. He was taller than Paul, you know I'm speaking about. About 6'7", he weighed over 250 pounds, and I was so anxious that he'd befriend me. And then he looked at me and said, "What's your name?" I said, "They call me Klim Bash in prison camps." "What's your name?" He said, "I'm Jock Davies." And I said, "Come on, pal, let's be friends." And that smile was still there, and he said, "Just tell me one thing. Do you know the best friend a man can ever have?" And I said, "If he's like you, Jock, wow, the three of us would clean up the German army." And then he looked at me and he said, "Do you know my friend Jesus Christ?" I said, "What?" And he said, "Do you know my friend Jesus Christ?" And I said, "Come off it, you must be kidding. You sure you're not shell-shocked? Are you serious?" And this giant of a man put an arm around my shoulder. And I can feel the pressure of that hug as he said to me, "Clem, we're going to be pals from now on. But oh, if it's the last thing I ever do, I want you to know my friend Jesus." That was the secret of the smile on his face. He knew the joy of the Lord. We arrived at the labor camp. We went through certain processes there. We were detailed to work hard labor. And I said, "I'm sorry, I don't work. I've never liked work all my life, and I still don't. That's why I'm a pastor today in a church. I preach once a week." And they said, "If you don't know how to work and you're not willing to work, we're going to make you or we are going to break you." And I said, "You'll have to begin the breaking process." And little did I know that I was giving God authority, as it were, to release my mother's prayers and the prayers of Jock Davies, because that was what would happen. God was going to put in a process of breaking Clem Gates. They put me into a little prison in solitary confinement, starvation diet. I was there about 2 days. Nothing to eat but a hot kind of a soup. And then early one morning, I listened and I couldn't believe what I heard. I was brought up in Sunday school. I knew some of the hymns they sang, and particularly "What a Friend We Have in Jesus." And I couldn't mistake the tune. Someone was whistling in a German concentration camp the hymn, "What a Friend We Have in Jesus." And I looked through the grid. It could only be one man. There was Jock Davies. This Scotsman, he had a pick and a shovel over his shoulder. And a gang of 19 men, 20 of them, had volunteered to work. And they went out, and as they passed the prison where I was, within reach of where I was, I began to curse and to blaspheme. They were traitors who'd sold out to the enemy. And I knew what they deserved. But they knew I deserved something more than what I wished for them. That afternoon late, as they returned back, right past the prison where I was gazing through the grid, when Jock Davies broke rank and he came across quickly, as quick as one could do it, with a huge piece of German turnip, a Swede they call it. And he put this raw vegetable through the grid. And then I realized why Jock Davies had volunteered to work. I got stuck into that piece of turnip till my tummy got stuck out. I'd never tasted anything so delicious in all my life. The next day was the same process, until late in the afternoon, as the work gang returned and the grid received the piece of turnip, there came with it a fearful command. The cry from a German soldier's lips that would bring terror to any prisoner. Simple words, "Kommst, mein Liebe," come, my dear one, like a Judas kiss. Using words of endearment, but we knew that when they used that expression, somebody was going to be hurt, someone would be tortured, and they had called my friend Jock Davies, "Kommst, mein Liebe," and I knew he would be punished for what he did. I couldn't sleep that night. The early hours of next morning, I was taken out of the prison to a courtyard, made to sit down on a bench. And this was a strange situation. They began to march young soldiers into the courtyard. It was crowded out with men, and about 8 paces from where I sat was a stake about 4 feet tall driven into the ground. And I wondered what this was all about. And I didn't care if it meant I would have to suffer on that stake. But it wasn't me. They brought my friend Jock Davies in, stripped to the waist. They bound his hands to that stake. And I was fastened to the chair and had to watch as they began to beat him up with rubber truncheons. And my heart was crying out, what has this man done? Of what crime is he guilty? The only thing he did was to feed a starving man. And my soul was rebelling in me, and I was crying, spare him, I'm the guilty one. Bind me to the stake, beat me up, kill me if you must, but he's my friend, release him. They carried Jock away. They put me back into the cell. A few days went by, and I couldn't believe it. I heard the whistling. What a friend we have in Jesus. And I looked through the grid, and there he was, this giant of a man, but his body stooped, his face bruised, black and blue and puffed. Carrying a pick and shovel, going out, still whistling, what a friend we have in Jesus. When they came back that evening, he had the biggest piece of turnip he could ever lay hands on. And he pushed it through the grid, and as I grasped it, I heard again the terrifying command, Kommst mein Lieber, oh Jock, why did you have to do it again? They took me out at the same time. And they marched the two of us to the headquarters into a large room where an officer sat behind a table. He was a member of the Gestapo, a short, hefty, stocky man. They made their report to him. He gave an order, and within 20 minutes that room was packed out with young soldier men. And then this officer stood up and he said, all you men, I want you to look at those two prisoners. There is a picture of a comradeship that only death can separate. Release them. We were dumbstruck. We couldn't believe it, that there was to be no punishment. We hugged each other, but we didn't know what those words were to mean in months to come. Have a good look at true comradeship. Only death can separate this friendship. Let them go. The weeks went by, the months. By that time I was broken in, but I was still very shrewd. I suggested to the authorities that they needed an interpreter, a dolmetscher, because the men weren't doing the job as they ought to be doing it. They didn't understand the German language. And because my home language was German, I would be able to interpret to them and they'd have a better job done. And they said that was wise. So they made me the dolmetscher. I had a ball of a time. It wasn't my fault that I wasn't quite so fluent and that I made so many mistakes and sabotage was in process. But we had a wonderful time. But the best times of all, as I look back now, were the times when Jock Davies was witnessing and sharing his faith. There wasn't a night that went by when Jock Davies, who slept on the upper deck of a double-decker bed, did not lower down his little Bible, and he would say to me, Clem, won't you open this Bible once and read only one verse? I would grab the Bible and I'd throw it to the dust. I didn't need a Bible. I didn't need his Jesus. And then I was roused from my sleep the early hours of the morning. The bed was rocking. And I thought there was one of the sortie air raids that were in progress at that time. But it wasn't an air raid. I discovered that my friend Jock Davies was bombarding the throne of heaven with his prayers. And I can still see him as I look up. His face was turned heavenward. And the tears were running down his cheeks. And he was crying, "Oh God, have mercy on my friend Clem. Oh God, save him." And then the last prayer I heard at the foot of my bed was something like this: "Oh God, if you have to break his heart to bring him to Jesus, break his heart." God sometimes takes us up on our prayers. And I don't know why God had to take him serious when he made that prayer. Because God then put in a process of breaking my heart. A few months after that, we come toward the end of the war. It was the 16th of December 1944. By then the Russians were beginning to close in on Nazi Germany. On that day, we were to rest. Winter had just struck. There'd been the first fall. The ground had frozen in. But with freak warm weather, it began to thaw. It was mucky. It was muddy. And it was our rest day, and we were so glad, until an officer came in and called me aside and said, "Mr. Dolmetscher, will you get your working gang down to the factory immediately?" And I said, "Nein, today is our rest day." He said, "Tomorrow you rest." They marched us down to the factory site. And there they told us we had to complete some of the work that other prisoners had been detailed to do. The three French prisoners of war were digging deep, deep pits. They were about 10 feet square, and they were so deep you could hardly see the bottom when you looked down. And then they would put steel girders into those pits, and my work gang had to fill those pits up with concrete. But we were so glad for winter because we made sure that we filled them up with ice blocks and had just a little thin layer of concrete on top. And wow, when we had our first air raid, they just didn't stand up to that. But on this day, they said, "You're not going to mix concrete. Today, we want your men, one at a time, to go down into that pit, down a ladder, taking a bucket to which a rope is attached, dig down another 2 feet, the earth to be pulled out by the other men, and when you've gone 2 feet deeper, you go home." I looked and I trembled. I said, "Nein, das ist Gefahr. It's dangerous." They said, "No. Nothing is dangerous until it's proved dangerous." I said, "We refuse. It's a death trap. There's no doubt about it. The sides are going to collapse." And they laughed and said, "Nothing is dangerous till it's proved dangerous." So the man in charge sent a messenger to the headquarters. In good time, an army vehicle arrived. An officer got out and there were 6 young boys with him. They were about 12, 13 years of age. They had black uniforms on. Each one had a machine gun. And this officer came to me and I recognized him. He was short and stocky, a black uniform on. And he looked into my face with a big grin and he said, "Ah, mein Freund, we meet again." And I spat on the ground and I cursed. I said, "Don't call me friend." He said, "What's the problem?" I said, "Find out for yourself." He said, "I don't have to. I gave the instructions. I command that one of your men goes into the pit and digs another 2 feet down." And I said, we refuse. He said, all right, get the men into a long line. 20 men stood in a line. A few paces opposite, 6 young soldiers stood with machine guns. And he said, I'm going to give you 30 seconds. And if there's no volunteer, these boys will bury 20 men in the pits here. Every man stepped forward. And then he said, only one can go down. And I'm going to be fair. I will give every man a chance. Get back into line, which we did. He said, I'm going to take 10 paces and I'm going to turn my back on you and I'm going to call out a number. And the number I call out is the number of the man who goes into the pit. I was number 1, Jock was number 2. Without a word spoken, we changed places. I thought he was marked, he thought I was marked. And the officer stopped. The silence was shattered by one word, one, number one. And my friend Jock Davies was standing where I should have been standing. I stepped forward and said, 9, I was standing there, I'm going down into the pit. And the officer said, it makes no difference so long as it's one of the two of you. And we knew then it was a plotted, planned murder. Every man volunteered. Jock was too good, we said, to die. He had a wife and a little boy way back home in Scotland. He cried many times. I watched him. He didn't know it. But tears ran down his cheeks as he was praying for that wife and that little boy back home. And then Jock Davies looked at the 19 of us and he said, men, I'm the only one who is fit to go down into that pit and I'm going down. And he turned and he fixed his eyes into my face and the smile was radiant. And he said, oh, Clem, I want you to know my friend Jesus. Jock climbed down the ladder into the pit. He was only there a few seconds. And the place shook and rumbled as the sides collapsed. And there was the laughter, ja, das ist Gefahr, it is dangerous. And my only friend, the best friend I ever had, was buried beneath the debris. 19 men dug until our nails were pulled off our fingers. We got Jock out. What was left of him? We marched. The silent death march. Back to our quarters. I remember taking off what kind of clothing I had. And asking the others to do the same because we had no beds in which to put a broken body. We made a soft padding. We laid Jock out. I was kneeling at his side and for the first time since leaving home, I was crying like a little boy again. But I was crying tears of anger. At 7 o'clock that night, 16th of December, 1944, Jock went to be in the presence of his Jesus. I rebelled. I raised my fist in God's face and said, you don't exist. You've taken my buddy, the only friend I ever had. And he loved you, he said. There's no God. There's no hell. There's no heaven. So why not end it all? And I looked into the building. By night time, we didn't have guards that patrolled these camps. All able-bodied men were sent to the front. The Russians were invading. So at night time, they would release big black Alsatian dogs into these camps. And no man would dare to get out of one of those living quarters at night. But there were huge windows. We called them the windows of death. And many a night we would see a man who couldn't take any more if he jumped through that window, and we would hear the screams and the growls of the dogs as they fought for his body. And I thought that if the dogs didn't like me, I would make the electrified perimeter. But I would put an end to it once and for all. And I can remember jumping, and I can remember running, and I can remember seeing lights flashing all around as I fell over a tripwire before I got to the electrified perimeter. The sirens were screaming. The spotlights were focused on that spot. But no dogs came. Two old soldiers came. They lifted me up, and the one hit me over the head. And they left me to lie, exposed to the elements to die. But God had His plan and purpose. I never regained or recovered consciousness until many days afterward. And I heard the story how that early next morning, a man from India, a medical man who was in a prison camp, was passing by and saw the huddled form, and when he kicked it over, he happened to feel and discovered a flicker of a pulse, and he took me into the medical aid quarters, and they told me how he had fought to save my life. Day and night he had sat there that I could live, but they couldn't bring him near to me because I would have strangled him. Didn't he know that he'd spoilt it? Didn't he know I was planning to end it all? And so they took me away from that camp, sent me to another camp where I recovered to some measure from the extremely severe damage that was done to the head. In that camp I met another man by the name of Charlie Hamilton. And he didn't make a profession of faith, so we were buddies involved in sabotage. They invited me to join the gang. There were 9 of them all together. As the Russians were coming nearer to the place where we were, the Germans gave orders for us to dig into the hillside. They said they would be shelters against the Russians, but that was to be their last stronghold, and we would have no part with that. So we went, and we were doing sabotage. We were blowing out the power works. This gang of 9 men were on the rampage. I thank God now for having been part of that anyway. But there came a morning when we came out of that tunnel after plunging it into darkness and bringing to a halt the power, that we heard the voice, "Kommst, mein Lieber?" And they took the 2 of us, Charlie Hamilton and myself, and then they interrogated us. They wanted to know who the other members of the gang were. And 3 days, 3 nights, we were put in the dehydrating room, a small room, just a table where a man sat behind the table. You stood with your head in a clamp and your hands behind your back. And then they would ask you 2 questions. How did you do it? Who else is doing it? How did you do it? Who else is doing it? Until your mind was going crazy. But we blocked our minds. We'd been trained in going out in sorties and how to block our minds if we should be caught. But oh, what a traumatic experience. I could have just exposed it and been shot, but it wasn't me. There were 7 other men's lives in jeopardy because they couldn't get a confession. They sent Charlie and me to what they called a straflager, a punishment camp. We didn't know what was in store for us, but it couldn't be worse than what we were experiencing. Oh, yes, it was a little worse. God was in that straflager, and I didn't want to be where God was. And God was there in the light of a little Jew. As we entered the gates late that afternoon, He sat at the entrance. You could hardly recognize Him as a living being. His whole body was shrunken from starvation. His eyes were deep sockets. His cheeks were hollow. And he looked up at us as we were passing by, and I caught one word he uttered. It sounded like Bible. And I stopped and said, "You asking me for a Bible?" And this emaciated face became radiant. And he said, "You Inglés, you got Bible?" And I cursed. This Englishman didn't have a Bible. We went into the living quarters, and that night we noticed the light burning at the end of the building. So Charlie and I, for want of something to do, moved down to see what it was all about. And there that little man was sitting, and he had a Bible about this size in front of him with a little lamp burning. And then God began to work in my soul. I looked down at this little man, and then something began to release within me. And I said, "Tell me your life story. There's something different about you." And he told us how they, as a Jewish family, had been converted to the Christian faith in Nazi Germany. His father was shot by the Gestapo for ministering to people in need. And how he himself was praying, how he was teaching, how he was ministering, until he was caught. And they put him in a concentration camp and said, "Jew, if you're ever found in the attitude of prayer or speaking about God, we'll send you to the camp of Three Chimneys." And I remembered when we came in that afternoon, there were three tall chimneys in the distance. I didn't know then, but we discovered they were the gas chambers. And then he told us how one night in that camp where he was a prisoner, a man was dying. And this man was crying for God, for someone to help him to make peace with God. And I can see that little Jew getting so excited as he was telling what happened. Excuse me. He said, "I couldn't let him die like that." And he said, "I didn't care what they'd do to me. I took him in my arms and I held him up. And I began to tell him the gospel message." And he said, "That man died in my arms, saved." And he said, "They let me finish my prayer. And that's why I'm here in this camp now." I was mesmerized. I, who was so hard, was gripped by this man's testimony of belief and faith. And I said to him, "Jew, where did you get that book?" And he said to me, "They heard me asking when you came into camp. And they took me to the officer and they reported me. And the officer gave me this Bible and said, 'Jew, you read this Bible, you'll never read a Bible again ever after this night.'" And I said, "Jew, that Bible, does it fill your stomach? That Bible, does it take away the hurt and the pain in your heart? That Bible make you sleep?" Oh, his face was radiant. "Comrade," he said, "all that this book does." And then I knew it was going to come. I knew it was going to come, and I braced myself. And he said, "Comrade, you need Jesus." I didn't need Jesus. I didn't need a Bible. I didn't realize it then, but I realize now, friend, what a great, mighty God we've got. This man who was dying for the gospel's sake had only one desire in his heart the night before he was to be executed, and it was that he might take the sacred book in his hand one more time, that he may page the sacred book, that he might just seep his soul with the precious promises of all the requests he could have made. The only thing he needed was a Bible, the Jesus of the Bible.
And what a mighty God we've got, because He tells us in Psalm 37, if we delight in Him, He'll give us the desire of our hearts. And God placed a Bible in that Christian Jew's hands, and He used the hands of a Gestapo officer to do it. What a God we've got. Tell me, what's this book mean to you? Oh, I've never seen so many Bibles as I've seen since we've come to the United States. But how many of these Bibles were opened in the home today? I'm not speaking about in your Sunday school class. I'm talking about those moments when you're alone with God and you're reading the precious Word and it comes alive in your soul. At first light next morning we stood at the gate and we saw him. They allowed him to take the book with him. And there was an old soldier on each side of him. They took his boots off that he would have to walk on the frozen ground the last mile of life to the gas chamber. But his head was lifted up from prison to paradise. The Spirit of God burnt into my soul. I can never forget seeing what I saw then, the reality of it and the glory of it, that our Christian faith is a living reality, that for me to live is Christ and to die is gain, whether you're in a concentration camp or in the United States or in South Africa, He's the same Jesus yesterday, today and forever. If only we could grasp the reality and the truth of it. I came out of that staff lager on a stretcher. I was too weak almost to walk. I'd had 6 weeks of it. Came into the early part of March 1945. The war was virtually at an end. I recovered just enough in the camp I was taken to have to go into the courtyard and hear the instructions that every man in that camp would have to go and dig a trench the length of his body and about 2 feet deep. And then they told us how much they loved us. They said the Russian forces were coming at night. We could see their guns blazing in the distance. And they didn't want us to be run over by Russian tanks. So if we dug those trenches the length of our bodies and 2 feet deep, we could lie prone and the tanks would go over us. But we learned afterward those were to be our own graves. They wouldn't give men over to the Russians. But before they could do that, God had intervened and the orders were changed. And they said every man to take what clothing and what food he had. We didn't have much. But what we had we took, and they said you're going to march to freedom. You're going to march to the West. Then began what became known as the Death March across Germany. This was in March 1945, the coldest winter Europe ever experienced. 800 men set out on that Death March. I could have died, but now I didn't want to die. There was something in me that wanted to live, and I can't describe it, only God knows, and maybe I know now in a better way. I'm not going to go through the details of those 500 miles of terror, nightmare, of seeing men drop by the wayside to die. All that I had was a hunk of horse meat. And when we stopped long enough, we boiled it and I drank the broth and shared it with another buddy I had. And we would suck on that meat to try to get some nutrition out of it. We arrived at a place called Mark Pongo just at the beginning of May. 200 survived out of 800 men. And I'm still asking God why. There were better men than I was who should have survived. And then a few weeks after we came in at Mark Pongo, I heard the American language for the first time, and you couldn't mistake it. It hasn't changed since then. General Patton and his TIs had moved into that part of Austria over on the west towards Switzerland. And I was released by General Patton's forces. There were 32 of us who were found in the Austrian forests. We were just skeletons with a little bit of breath in them. They took me to the first aid post. And I can't leave the side of my life story. I owe so much to the United States, but can you believe, after all I'd been through, that your GIs wanted to kill me? I lay stretched out on that kind of a bed they had for me, and a huge GI came in, and he looked at me, and he said, "Buddy, would you like some candy?" And I looked at him and I said, "What's candy?" And he came out of the slab of chocolate candy like that. Well, I started here and I got through there before you could say Jack Robinson. And then another GI came in and he looked at me and he said, "Hey guy, would you like a camel?" I said, "A camel?" And he said, "Yeah." And he put in my hands a whole packet of camels. You know what camels are? Fags. Cigarettes. Wow, I changed my life. And for 2 weeks they fought to save my life. Can you imagine it? After all I'd been through, to die in circumstances like that. Well, enough of that. I was taken from the camp in Mark Pongo to Salzburg. I was an exhibit there. 32 of us were taken. We were exposed to those who were the judges and the jury and what have you. And oh, I don't know of anything more degrading or humiliating than to be a human being who is being exhibited. When people come and they open your jaws to see what's happened inside your mouth, and they begin to feel and to count the ribs. Then we were moved to Reims in France. We were the guests of the GIs there for 2 weeks. And that was the first time I knew what the millennium was all about. Drafted over to England. From England back home to South Africa. But not the boy who left home. A man whose mind was blown. A man who was just a number. A man who could not identify with society. A man who didn't believe there was a God. A man running away, running away, running away from himself, but nowhere to hide. I got off the train in my little hometown. My mama was there. The whole town was there. There were two of us who lived in that hometown. Her hair turned white. That notified her I'd been killed. For 6 months she mourned my death. But she believed her boy would come home, and her boy had come home. Never mind if he was so drunk he couldn't stand on his feet. My boy is home. He's celebrating. Who wouldn't celebrate? Oh God, if only it had been to celebrate. But it was trying to run away. Run away. Run away from myself. And then the days went into weeks, the weeks into months, and the people shook their heads and said, "We can't understand. He doesn't relate. He doesn't open his heart. He has no place or time for God." And then my friends began to drop away. My family became ashamed and embarrassed of me. And then I was called the village drunk. Because that's the only way I could forget. Oh yes, there were the holy huddlers. Those who came and said, "We're praying for you, you evil, wicked man. You're breaking your mother's heart. Why don't you begin to pray?" And I said, "What must I pray about?" And they said, ask God to forgive you. Forgive me for what? For drinking your life into the grave. But I saw nothing wrong with drinking alcohol. I never broke into bottle stores. I had no sense of wrongness there. And they said, if you don't stop drinking, you'll end in hell. Oh, they didn't know what hell was. Hell was when you stood in a dehydrating room and you heard them say, how did you do it? Who else did it? And your lips are swollen and your tongue is swollen and you want a drop of water and there's no water. They didn't know what hell was. But God wasn't finished with me. The only one I had left was an old mama. She was still praying. Still praying. 18 months went by, December 1946. I shall never forget that Friday. I came home. The earlier part of the evening, I fell over a coffee table. And I lay prone on the floor and I looked, sensing a presence. There was a minister in that little lounge. But I didn't move, and my mama came in. Then I heard her cry for the first time. I heard her cry and say, oh God, why didn't you take my boy when I heard he was killed? She would have been a proud mama. But now she was the mama of the village drunk. That old minister got up, put his arms around her and said, mama, we understand. Why don't you give him up? God's given him up. I crawled out of that room. If God's given me up, I didn't believe in him anyway. I'd take my life. I planned it all that night. I schemed it. The Saturday morning I ordered 2 wreaths, one to be delivered that day and the other one on the Monday. The one on the Monday would be for my own funeral. But the one on the Saturday that night I would lay it at the war memorial in my little hometown where I was born and reared, in memory of the only man who was ever my friend, Jock Davies. That Saturday night I went to the war memorial. I put the wreath down and all the past came back. And I could hear the awful cries, Ya das ist gefahr. Then I heard another voice. The voice of a young lady about 18 years of age who, how she got there only God knows. But she'd been visiting my home. She lived in East London, 60 miles away. And she was there for the weekend, a friend of my sister's. And God put her at that place and she said to me, I'm praying for you. That was new language. Everybody said, you pray for yourself. She said, I'm praying for you. And I said, me, do you know who I am? I'm the village drunk. And she said, God loves you. And I said, who's God? I've got some questions to ask him. Where is God? And she said, I don't know how to understand it, but God loves you. And Jesus, his son, died for you. Then I exploded. There was only one man who ever died for Clem Gates. And that man was Jock Davies. And the whole story came out and she listened. And then she said, yes, just like that. That man had to die that you could come home alive. And Jesus died on the cross of Calvary that you, Clem Gates, the village drunk, you don't have to die a drunkard's death. You know, friends, in each, every one of us, there is something that is reaching out to God, whether we believe it or not. I didn't want to be what I was, but nobody could help me to be other than what I was. And I said to her, how can I find God? Only one way. Get down on your knees and ask God to forgive you. And then I pushed her aside and said, I don't come begging to God. How hard, how stubborn can a man be? But God seemed to knock me behind my knees. And before I knew what, I was down on my knees. And something began to happen. I saw that scene again. I saw the stake in the ground. I saw a man who was bound to it. But it was a different scene this time. He was a man not tied to a stake, but with his hands outstretched on a cross. And he was looking down at me, and my heart was crying and saying, "What crime have you committed to die like that?" And the lips were moving, and it was saying, I love you, Clem Gates." That night, I met Jock's friend, Jesus. That night I met Jock's friend, Jesus. I don't know how it happened. No bright light. No sounds of thunder crashing. I didn't even hear the angels rejoicing as Jesus said they would. But I was there when it happened. I was still wobbly drunk. But oh, it was a brand new world. There was a peace in my heart. Gone were the fears. Gone was the bitterness. All the sheer bliss of that moment of seeing Jesus by faith for the first time. And I wanted to sing. I didn't know what to sing. I'd forgotten Jesus loves me. I'd forgotten that. So I sang "It's a Long, Long Way to Tipperary." But I sang. I sang as I weaved my way to my home. Curtains opened, there he goes, to break his mother's heart again. But oh, it was a different story this time. And I entered that front door with the long passage, three doors on each side. We were a big family. And I looked and I saw her come running down, my mama that night. And she left with her arms around my neck, and we went down to the floor. And I was wet with her tears, and she said, "Son, you've come home at last." And I looked at my watch, it was 9:05. And I said, "Earlier, Mama, than usual." "No," she said, "you've come home. You were lost, but now you're found. You were dead, but you're alive." And oh, she praised and she thanked God for bringing her boy back. The weeks, the months that followed were hard. I had the withdrawals from alcohol, abuse. I still had some flashbacks. But I had God. And that was enough. I had God. And I had Jesus. And I had that little Sunday school teacher. And I married her 12 months later. You couldn't blame me, could you? We shared our lives together. For 10 years I was in secular work. But out of God's place, till He called us, put us where He wants us to be. We never look back. Tell me, what's this book mean to you, friend? If tonight you were told that you'll not see the dawn of tomorrow, would you have asked for this book? How precious is the name of Jesus to you, to you? If you were forbidden ever to utter it, the penalty, your life, what would you do if somebody was dying and you would have to put on his lips, from your lips, the sweetest name of all, Jesus? Would you be willing to?